blares the horn, and that lets you know it's time to talk about your car today here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and great to have back Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors, over 10 years of master certification, stops by every other month to help you out with your vehicle questions. And today we'll talk a bit about oil, synthetic oil for your vehicle, and some other types of oils. But of course, we'll take your questions about your own car. What problems are you having? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here today.
Well, it's great to have you here. And before we talk about the kinds of oils, what does oil really do in an engine?
Well, its primary function is lubrication, but it also is a cooler. It does help cool significantly. Engines, larger engines with large oil sumps and more oil, and have a significant cooling factor involved in that oil. It is also a detergent. Engine oil gets dirty from the combustion process and from exposure to air and to moisture that forms in the lubrication system, and there are detergents to help. As the oil breaks down, it can start to varnish and leave a film on things, and that varnish can be a self-promoting thing that gets worse and worse. So the detergents help prevent that from gelling up and creating that varnish in the first place. And it's a sealant to some effect too. In the combustion chamber where the piston is, the oil is part of what helps with the piston rings to seal and produce that combustion and the process.
So it has all kinds of uses, really. And so the different kinds of oil are going to work different. Talk about the different kinds of oil.
Well, conventional oil is basically crude oil that does have additives. It does have detergents added to it over the years, compounds, zinc, phosphorus, boron, and all things that were typically added to oil, and actually some of those they've been phasing out over years. Synthetic oil doesn't necessarily have to start from crude. There are completely synthesized, chemically synthesized synthetic oils, but most do start from crude, go through the same original refining process, but then they're actually distilled and then synthesized even further to try to get the molecules to be very consistent. It can get very complicated to talk about all, but one of the simplest analogies that I had ever heard that kind of helps you understand the difference is you could imagine conventional oil being like river stones. Imagine some very, very similar river stones spread out across the floor, and you come running up and try to slide on them. You'll slide a little bit, but not a great deal. And, you know, it does act there. As opposed to synthetic oil, which you can imagine more like marbles.
And everyone's
the same size. Everyone's the same way. So if you either imagine them on the floor or imagine pouring them through a funnel where the funnel is at least as big as the you know, a little bit bigger than the largest molecule, the marbles are going to whip through that funnel a lot quicker than river stones that are not all exactly the same. So that is a very basic analogy that leaves a lot of the additives and things out, but essentially sure. that's kind of the big difference.
So why don't we all just use synthetic oil then, if it sounds like it's a better oil in a lot of ways?
Well, it's 2 to 4 times more expensive, and typically if you have an older car, whether or not to use synthetic oil, it isn't necessarily just a good idea to use synthetic oil because it is a better oil. It is a better lubricant. It is a better cooler, but do you need it? Engines that are exposed to a lot of stop-and-go use, engines that are exposed to heavy load, pulling heavy loads consistently, and, you know, in extreme climates, extreme cold, extreme heat, the synthetic oil's got advantages that conventional oil doesn't have. So even if you have an old classic, that would never have called for conventional oil originally. If you hot rod it, if you build an engine up, the synthetic oil has got some superior qualities to help protect that motor. But typically speaking, the manufacturers don't recommend the longer intervals that synthetic oils generally allow on modern engines that are designed to use those oils. And really, modern engines that are designed primarily around synthetics are not really intended to use conventional oil. That being said, any oil is better than no oil.
You know, that's for sure.
It's not like if you put conventional oil in a car that was supposed to have synthetic, that it's not going to run, it's not going to start. It's just that over the long term, that engine, you know, the higher compression engines, direct injection, are a lot of things that put more wear and strain on modern engines. So the synthetic oil is good and typically can have longer intervals. And really, the longer intervals and the lower use of petroleum products because of those longer intervals is one of the main goals of engineering it that way. When they first started coming out with some of these lighter weight oils last few years, 0W16, we kind of joke as water. the number designations, the first number in an oil designation is the way that oil behaves at a cold temperature. So 0W16, the W stands for winter. And so the number on the left is its winter cold behavior. The number on the right is its hot behavior. The lower those numbers, the better it's going to perform in really cold conditions. And the higher those numbers, the better it performs in really hot conditions. But more and more, they're going to things like 0W16 oil
not the old 10W30 that I always put in.
No. And you know, if you have an older vehicle and you're going to use that in it, then you're going to pay a lot more for it. And if the interval that you were supposed to change that is 3,000 or 5,000 miles, you're going to be spending a lot more on oil. One alternative, you can experiment a little bit. There are plenty of companies that you can send an oil sample into, your used oil, when you change it, and they'll do an analysis and tell you the content of the fuel dilution and various harmful metals that might be in it that can cause damage to the engine. And you can kind of get a determination if you stretch your oil change. If it's supposed to be at 5,000, you go 5,500 or 6,000 miles and send in that oil sample and they say everything looks good, you might experiment over time and find that you can go a bit longer, but you're probably not, it's never going to really be a good idea to go double the interval. 10,000 miles, like the modern engines that are designed to use that oil, will run as a standard interval.
Yeah. And if you're in the middle of that, if you do that test, but then summer comes along and you haul your boat, your big boat, 300 miles up and 300 miles back, that's a different situation.
Sure, that can change everything. And there's a difference in how motor oil is affected by in-town short trip driving as opposed to long trip highway driving as well. So those are big differences.
Well, Joe in Eau Claire has a question about synthetics, I believe. So let's go there. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I have an old sports car, 2002 BMW with the S54 engine, and that has a special oil for that engine, Castrol. I can't remember if it's 560 or 1060 or whatever the weight is. And the car is stored an awful lot of the time. I might drive it several hundred miles per year.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do, the driving is usually, you know, longer than 20 or 30 minutes at a time, more like 40 to an hour at a time.
Yeah.
What would be the interval for changing the oil in a car like that?
Well, the manufacturer is going to tell you to change it by time or mileage, whichever comes first. And that on 2002, I don't know what their recommendation was. And this becomes one of those things where it might require some experimentation. The car sitting as much as it does, if it's sitting, you know, in a heated storage situation, that's different than if it's in cold storage. It's still going to get some moisture buildup in it. Inevitably, you know, again, in a heated storage, you have more control over this, but in cold storage, the engine heats up just from the ambient temperatures heating up. When it gets warm, it cools down from the ambient temperatures cooling down. That allows condensation and moisture to form in the engine and could justify a reason to change it. The best answer, though, again, is an oil analysis. You know, you take that oil when you have it changed and send it in and find out if it's good. You might go a little bit longer if it's, you know, if you find that it's good. And when you go a little bit longer, test it again, send it in and see if it's still testing good. And that's the only way you're really going to be sure.
Yeah. There we go, Joe. Does that help?
It does. It cost me about $100 just to buy the oil for one oil change. So,
Yeah, it's worth testing then for sure to see if you can stretch that out.
To test it.
AMS Oil does that. There are a lot of different companies out there that do, though, and I mean, I think the testing starts at about $40, so compared to $100 for the oil, it's probably worth it, because in all likelihood, you can stretch that interval under your specific use conditions. But, you know, you
also got an expensive, valuable car there.
Yep, you don't want to harm that engine. And, you know, you're probably not going to, but, you know, the only way to really dial it in is to find out what is in that waste oil.
Yeah. Good luck, Joe. Thank you so much. James in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, James.
Hi, Larry. Love your show. Love NPR.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. When the synthetics came out, I read that in older cars, they can actually cause seal leaks. So I want to know if this made sense. I've always used a blend just in case you got the benefits of both. And my second question, are there any synthetics for diesel engines? That's about all I got. Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
There are engine oils that are specifically for diesel engines and different use engines, and even in aircraft, jet engines versus piston engines have different oils. Diesels versus other heavy load work truck engines have specific oils. That being said, most of those oils are a bit more interchangeable than not. Any oil is better than none, but you should use what's specified for the vehicle type that you've got. In terms of the question, a couple of big myths, generally speaking, are that you can't use conventional oil, you shouldn't use conventional oil to cause oil consumption or oil leaks. There may be some truth to causing leaks. Not that it causes the seals to fail, but older oils, the more conventional oil than older engines, did allow for some varnish buildup. And in some cases, it is possible that varnish built up in a place
that was a
sealing surface where the gasket is no longer really a real viable gasket, but the varnish on the inside is actually helping seal some of that. And the theory is that the greater detergent properties and lubricating properties and such of the synthetic oil can clean up some of that varnish, which then leads to some leaks. I think that's pretty rare. I don't think that's a common scenario. I think 99 times out of 100, someone switching an older vehicle to synthetic oil is not going to have that problem. But it depends on the condition of that engine. And so, really, if it's a much older vehicle, a classic or something, you know, I would probably pull the valve cover, top cover off that engine and look and see if there does appear to be a lot of varnish buildup on the top of the engine. If there is there, there's going to be in other places, and that may be a bit of a concern. But generally speaking, that is more of a myth than true. That is not the typical scenario.
Thanks, James. Appreciate it. John in Madison, your turn. Hi, John.
Oh, thank you for taking my call today.
Sure.
I have a question. I have a 2008 Toyota RAV4. In the last year, it's kind of been showing that it started to consume oil over time. Probably, I'd say I've needed to add a quart probably every 800 to 1,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And I read online that it might have some bad piston rings. So I'm just wondering if the type of oil that I run in it could help alleviate that problem, that symptom a little bit, and if getting the piston rings changed would make sense or not.
Right. There are updated pistons and piston rings for that countermeasure. They're different than what was originally in the car to countermeasure that on that year and model of the RAV4 and the four-cylinder engine. Typically, the original recommendation was to perform an oil consumption test, which is basically to make sure the car is full, drive it somewhere in the range of 1,100 to 1,300 miles, check the oil, and if it's more than a quart low, then the idea is that it's excessive enough oil consumption that it should have the repair done. If it's less than that, then the conventional wisdom is that it's cheaper to simply monitor your oil level and add oil rather than do the repair. There actually was a customer support program that originally would have been a repair that would have been covered by the original warranty of 5 years, 60,000 miles, and they did do an extension on many 07 and 08s to, I believe, 9 years, 150,000 miles. So you do want to check out and find out if your vehicle is still within that kind of a support program. And there are some things, important things to consider and be aware of if you have a car that consumes oil like that. This is not an oil leak. This isn't oil leaking out on the ground. This is oil that's being burned and with the fuel in the combustion chamber. One thing is that people often think that if my car is burning oil, it should smoke. But modern emission systems, catalytic converters, burn up that excess hydrocarbon and stuff, and you're not going to see smoke coming out the tailpipe like you might have back in the 80s or earlier cars before modern emission systems. The second thing to be aware of is that you might find that you have a very predictable level of consumption in your daily commuting. You might determine it's a quart to 1,500 miles, and you consistently add that, no problem. If you take that car on a trip, a long highway trip, you may find that that oil consumption doubles or triples. So, you know, it's fine if it's a quart and 1,500 miles to just get in the habit of adding oil in between. But if you take a trip, be aware to check it like every time you fuel up to make sure you stay ahead of it.
There you go, John. Thanks. Speaking of that whole business, I think Dan in Milwaukee has a question that kind of goes along with what you were just talking about. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. Lair, thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
A quick question for your guest. I know he's been, like, talking about this and how it's going to depend, like, the life of an oil is going to depend on the circumstances of each car. Is it true that there, if I'm putting more miles on my car, like every day or every week I'm putting a couple hundred miles on my car, my wife is putting on, you know, 3 miles a day or something like that, yeah, that my oil is going to, I can get more out of my oil?
Right. Everything else being normal in the car, you know, again, not a car that has oil consumption like the previous call. If everything else is normal, the engine's operating normally, the stop and start driving, the 3 mile trips are much harder on the oil than the long highway drives and the longer drives. Definitely true.
All right, there we go. Thanks so much for calling. All this talk, I was remembering, and maybe I've mentioned this to you on the air, but I bought a brand new Chevy Blazer many years ago and picked it up and literally drove it out of the lot and 300 miles because I was driving slow because, you know, you're breaking it in, mm-hmm, and all that. Started acting up, though, and I got to my destination, and I took it to the Chevy dealer, and he said, well, something's wrong. So I called back to Madison, and I drove it back, and I was putting a quart of oil in about every 20 miles, 25 miles. Come to find out that when the Blazer was constructed, the O-rings hadn't been put in on one side. So there are no O-rings.
You know, there are supposed to be overrides to stop an assembly line, obviously, when something happens, but things have become so automated every now and then. You know, something like we do see things like that every now and then that are just a complete anomaly, but yeah.
Now, well, I will say that the dealer was quite good about everything, and you know, it all got resolved. I got a new engine, and
sure, all the inspections that they can do after they put it together aren't going to reveal that until somebody takes it and drives it more than, you know, a couple of miles.
Yeah. Well, let's take some more calls. Oh, by the way, Joel in Green Bay emailed. He recently bought a Chevy Silverado 2015. The owner had used regular oil, not the Dexos 2 that Chevy recommends. Should he go to the Dexos 2 or continue to use regular motor oil? His engine has 60,000 miles on it.
Well, the Dexos 2 is a synthetic oil, and it's one of the latest pretty special synthetic oils. If the manufacturer recommends using that oil, that is what I would recommend using.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's not like one or two oil changes are going to cause that vehicle to break down. Obviously, it's really it's a difference in the macro picture. You know, are you going to get 300,000-400,000 miles out of it, or are you going to get 150,000-200,000 miles out of it?
Our guest today, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today. Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your automobile here on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Jim Ward, service director at Smart Motors. And we've been dealing a bit with oil, but we can take other questions as well. Certainly, if you have a question about your car, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Dave in Aston has something for us. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Larry. I've used synthetic oil since I was a teenager in my first vehicle. I kind of swear by them, although not scientifically. I have a fleet with vehicles over 200,000 miles with no engine repairs required. And I've used the testing services, and they evaluate your oil for contaminants, but they don't give a recommendation on continued use or changing. So I found that not real useful. I change the oil once a year, whether it needs it or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like you, Dave, my own personal experience on vehicles that I've had that did not require synthetic oils. But you know, not that I'm not necessarily recommending any one over another. But I, you know, had a Volkswagen that I ran Mobil 1 in, and bought the car new. Always ran that, and it had it close to a quarter million miles when I turned that one over to a brother-in-law who was a technician who thought he would, you know, he'd go through and rebuild the engine and go through the car, but when he took the top cover off, it was as clean as a whistle. And I've had that experience many times too. So, it is a superior lubricant. And I recall too, when my kids started driving, I couldn't dependably count on them bringing it back at a certain mileage. So I had a lot more confidence using that kind of oil and going on a calendar time frame, you know, chronological rather than the mileage. Just knowing that, I don't know how many miles I'm going to put on it, but I know I'm going to see them at Thanksgiving. So,
There we go.
Good thing to use.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Well, Matt in Madison has something for us. Hi there, Matt.
Hello. My question, I guess, is twofold. One is, how come the same engine in the United States will call for 0W20, and when you get down to Mexico, they call for 5W30? Is it just the corporate CAFE standards? They're trying to get a little better miles per gallon out of the vehicle in the U.S., so they spec a slipperier, more lubricant, you know, an oil with more lubricity. And the second question is I have an 09 Corolla manual transmission, and ever since about 200,000 miles, the car has started to consistently burn about 2 quarts of 0W20 every 5,000 miles. But if I switch to 5W30, it burns less than a quarter of a quart. So how can just, you know, by putting a slightly thicker oil in there, the oil consumption drops so significantly? It doesn't leak anywhere, so I know
right.
It's burning it.
Well, but in fact, it is leakage. It's not leakage externally, but it's leakage inside the engine, and that is the difference. It isn't that either of these oils are burning, as in igniting and burning up. It's that a thinner oil is, if you have valve seals or if you have piston rings that are worn and aren't doing their job completely, that thinner oil is going to leak through and ultimately will be burned in the combustion chamber. But it isn't the burn rate of the oil, it's the viscosity and how much is allowed to get in there. So although it's not an external leak, it is a leak issue that causes that oil consumption. And you have the different oils. And with the first question, absolutely, there are manufacturers do use CAFE ratings. You know, those are determinations to, you know, how you sell thousands of Corollas, for example, to a couple of Land Cruisers, and how many Land Cruisers you can import as a manufacturer, sometimes determined by those CAFE ratings. So manufacturers do play with those numbers. So in different countries, you might find different recommendations. There might be different build specs too. You know, the very same engine may have different pistons and piston rings in different markets, but no, there's absolutely truth of the CAFE ratings determining sometimes what that recommendation for oil is going to be.
Yeah, there you go, Matt. Thanks much for calling. And Jeff in Door County. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, hi, guys. I've got an 05 Accord Coupe. It's got 215,000 miles on it, manual. And I changed the timing belt at 100,000 as it said I'm supposed to. But when it got up to around 200, I brought it to the mechanic. And he said, don't change the timing belt because the car has zero tolerance or something like that, and you'll know if the timing belt needs to be replaced. Does that make sense to you?
When we talk about timing belts or timing chains, but generally a timing chain is considered to be a lifetime element. They aren't always, but timing belts are something that need to be replaced at an interval. But there are two types of engines. This isn't a friction belt like you think of on the front of the engine. That's just a smooth belt on a couple of pulleys. That tension is what keeps everything turning together. This is a gear cog belt that's more analogous to a bicycle chain, and the timing of the top of the engine and the bottom of the engine are critically controlled by that belt. Some engines are interference engines, meaning that if you just let them free spin, the design is such that the timing will be off and there isn't clearance between pistons and valves, and they'll hit and they'll completely destroy an engine. And a non-interference engine is you know, very similar, except it's built-in clearance, so that even if that belt slips, the timing's off, the belt's completely gone, and you spin those two separate halves of the engine, they're not going to collide. I believe that Honda is an interference engine. I wouldn't take that chance of the breakdown. I would get that belt replaced at the interval that it's recommended. Obviously, if they recommend 100,000 miles or 90,000 miles, it doesn't mean that right at that interval that it's going to fail. It might go another another 50,000 miles, but that's not a gamble that you want to take.
All right. There you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hello?
Hi. Hi, thanks Gary. For calling.
I have a 2013 Avalon and Limited, and all of a sudden, about a year or so ago, I started hearing this sound in the front. It sounded like air, some kind of air noise in the front on the right-hand side, like some kind of wind tunnel. And it would kind of sound a little strange when I get a crosswind. Mm-hmm. So it happens on and off here. And I did some research on it, and it seems like there are other people out here that have kind of had the same problem. Is there something, you know, inherently wrong with that model, or with this? Have you ever heard of that?
You know, we do see air leaks. There's for a given year model, like your 13 Avalon, in the course of a year after, or even years, but even the first year after a car like that's released, there'll be several service bulletins for different issues that are released. And I remember years ago, before it was all in electronic form, that by the end of the year they would publish a manual that had all those bulletins in it. It was the size of a small town phone book. I mean, so there aren't just a few. So I don't know right off the top of my head. That is, I mean, typically if there's a bulletin, you go on to various forums like Toyota Nation, they'll mention that and tell you. And if you call into the dealership, any dealership with the VIN number handy, they can run it and see if there's a bulletin for that specific type of problem. If there is not, you know, ultimately the way that we find those kind of noises is to, you know, ride with you and figure out how to duplicate it. And it's something you can kind of isolate yourself. I mean, you know, wind noises like that, we'll often see if a windshield's been replaced and they didn't get the replacement windshield sealed right, that can cause noises. A piece of trim gets a little bit displaced just from clearing ice and snow using a snow brush. It can catch wind and make a noise. But what we typically do is take paint masking tape and start masking off seams and areas like that and kind of mask the car off. And basically when you mask off the area where the read effect is happening, the noise goes away, and you kind of isolate it that way, and that's how you find where it is. And then what you do to fix it just depends on where it is and what the issue is.
Yeah, there you go, Gary. You can do it, do a little work yourself on that and do some testing. Thank you very much for calling. A listener emailed to ask what the major ingredient is in synthetic oil. Is it oil?
In most synthetic oils, it is crude oil. It is the same crude oil. It is processed and refined differently. It's beyond the refining. It's actually distilled and has, you know, different additives put into it. However, that being said, there are synthetic oils that are completely synthesized and don't start with crude. But that is not the rule. That is by far the exception.
Take another call on to Sue in Rhinelander. Hi, Sue.
Hi, Larry. I have a 2007 GMC Envoy, 142,000 miles. Should I switch to synthetic oil? I'm 73, and I want this car to last me forever.
Well, what kind of driving do you do?
City driving, highway. I pull a very small camper during the summer.
Yeah, so I mean that is a little bit of extra load on it. The synthetic oil is going to be a superior lubricant for that. Synthetic oils different. Synthetic oil is something that is retroapplicable. In other words, the standard conventional oil that was called for in that vehicle, all of the specs that synthetic oil have will cover everything that conventional oil would have done. So it is a superior lubricant. You will have longer engine life, generally speaking, if you use synthetic oil.
Yeah, so there you go, Sue. Good luck with that vehicle. And thanks for calling. Rick and Holman, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, I've got a question, and you just touched on it just a little bit. I use a 100% synthetic oil rather than a synthetic oil that starts with base oil number 2 as the main ingredient, and they put the additives in, and it's synthetic. What is the true difference in performance between 100% synthetic and an oil-based synthetic?
Well, the 100% synthetic, there's two differences. One of them, it is a superior lubricant and superior oil. And number two, it's far more expensive. So, you know, to justify the use of it, you know, it depends on the use of the vehicle. The amount of load, again, stop and go usage of a vehicle, extreme conditions like cold and hot, you know, those things might indicate that you're going to have an advantage by using a straight synthetic oil. But the cost generally,
what is the cost prohibitive. Roughly?
Oh, it's about four times the cost of a regular oil is. Yeah.
Okay.
And generally, we're not going to recommend that you run it longer, although that's the main reason most people want to do it, so they can run a longer interval. But again, that becomes a bit of experimentation and you know, trying to find out what's in that oil, have it analyzed to see if you're really changing it often enough.
All right. There you go, Rick. Does that help, by the way?
Well, kind of. I mean, the pure synthetic I use is about $650 a quart, so it's certainly not that much more expensive. I don't know. It just seems that it would be a better oil.
It is a better oil. There's no question about it. And, you know, your engine might, after $200-$300 miles, might be in the same condition having used either oil. But yeah, I can tell by listening to you and talking to you that you're going to sleep better if you use that synthetic oil.
Yeah.
And that's an important factor. You know, what we do and how we take care of our things is what gives us confidence and peace of mind in using them and know that they're going to work the way we want them to. So it's
going to work really well for you.
No question.
Yep, no question. So keep doing it, Rick. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
You bet. Jack and Mequon, your turn.
Hi, Larry and guest. I appreciate being able to ask the experts.
All right.
My question is, my spouse's car, which is a 2008 Lexus SUV, it's got 70,000 miles on it, and all we've done really is change the oil and flush antifreeze and the brake fluids. We put in seafoam gas additive a couple times a year, but actually no engine maintenance. Is there anything at 70,000 miles recommended that we should be doing to the car?
Well, engine maintenance and tune-up work doesn't have a perfectly clear definition, but generally we're talking about air filters, spark plugs, and increasingly engines have, as with almost all components and all systems on cars, they have less and less maintenance to those things. That engine, I believe, uses an iridium spark plug that doesn't have a replacement interval to 120,000 miles. When they first came out with those recommendations, we thought, oh, you're never going to get them out. By that time, they're going to be seized in the engines, and that has not proven to be true. We really don't see much of a problem with them at all. They perform just fine for those longer intervals. So there still is tune-up work, but the intervals that it's recommended at are much longer because of just superior technology and the new spark plugs and products. Air filters, engine maintenance, that's something that really should be looked at about twice a year. It varies a lot on you know, air filters for the engine are just determined by the conditions you have to drive under. And, you know, if one vacation trip driving through some dry area with a lot of dust in the air, some agriculture area can dirty up your air filter really quickly, whereas, you know, you might otherwise go a year without it not really getting exposed to much. So it should be checked twice a year just to make sure it's clean. But, yep, there's not a lot of engine maintenance to that.
There you go, Jack. Thank you so much for calling. Sue in Bailey's Harbor emailed to say when she puts her car in reverse from park, it makes a loud clunk noise. What could that be?
Well, I am presuming here that this is a noise that it hasn't always made, because when you change gears, when you put a vehicle in reverse, it is going to make some noise. There are lots of vehicles, for example, that have what's called a floating brake caliper by design. That caliper can move a little bit. So if you're going forward and then put it in reverse, that caliper can shift a little bit and the other way around too. So if you pull it in your garage, you brake and stop, the next morning you get in, put it in reverse, you may hear a click from those, which is a completely normal noise. But there's certainly lots of things that can be worn. It isn't necessarily indicative that there's something in the transmission, but it's a process of elimination. That's basically what needs to happen, is that, you know, presumably it's consistent and can be duplicated readily. And if that's true, then, you know, a technician can examine the car and determine what's making the noise and whether it's a serious condition, something that needs repair, or whether it's a normal characteristic.
John in Richland Center, we'll go to you next. Hi, John.
I'm a firm believer in preventative maintenance, and I have a Ford turbo diesel truck, and I want to get 500,000 miles out of it. Now, I know that the maintenance thing as far as changing the filters and changing the oil and flushing the radiator, but what do I need to do to... That turbo is got to have some maintenance along the way, doesn't it?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's no guarantee that a turbo is going to last 500,000 miles, but a turbocharger is one of those components on an engine that is a game changer in terms of what oil you might want to use and what is needed. Turbochargers produce an incredible amount of heat compared to just about any other engine component or engine running process. And so when it comes to turbochargers, that you know the recommendation for synthetic oil is greater than ever, and changing it at the right interval for the use that you have. 500,000 miles is certainly possible, but it's going to be as much an element of luck as, you know, I mean, assuming that you do everything you should and take care of it and change, you know, all the fluids and do the maintenance on time and use synthetic oil, that's a lot of miles. You know, I hope you make it, and you know, likely will, because you sound like you are very diligent in doing that. But yeah, a turbocharger is a game changer when it comes to engine oil and the importance of using the highest grade oil possible and changing it at the appropriate interval.
And somebody might wonder, what the heck's a turbocharger?
Well, a turbocharger is a device on the intake that basically has got a turbine that spins up and creates pressure and pressurizes the air and fuel going into the intake and gives you more power as a result of that.
All right, let's take some more calls here. And Brad in Lake Geneva, it's your turn. Hi, Brad. Thanks for calling. Did we lose Brad? I think we might have lost Brad. Well, let's try David in Madison then. David, hi.
Hi there. I might be dovetailing off of the last caller, but my question is, you hear about semi-trucks being able to drive hundreds of thousands, sometimes even a million miles. They might redo an engine or other things, but is that because they are built differently or maintained differently? And could such a thing be done with a standard car?
Well, it is because they're built differently, and even among diesel engines, there are differences. You know, when there are diesel engines that are, you know, fully expect to get hundreds of thousands, if not close to a million miles out of, other diesels that's typically not going to happen with. And diesel engines, there's a wide range. I mean, you brought up semis, but diesel engines are used in all kinds of construction equipment that have incredible loads put on them that they're never going to go that long. And then there are engines that are industrial engines that run things like generators that are a light load that really, you know, are likely to go a long, long time. But first of all, design and the make of the engine does have a significant effect. You know, the Cummins diesels from the 80s and early 90s are some of those engines that were, you know, in semis that were considered million-mile engines, and many of them did make it. That's not to say that they didn't require maintenance, and
yeah,
those engines have a lot, let me say that again, a lot more oil, and that the amount of oil, you know, a car is always designed to have more oil in its sump than is necessary for minimum operation, but those engines have a much, you know, the proportionate degree is much more, and it, that also is an effect, you know, on how long that oil is going to last and how well it's going to lubricate, cool, and clean that engine.
And thanks a lot, David, for that call. Jim Ward, our guest today, he's the service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're taking a look at your vehicle's maintenance today with our guest, Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. We have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Certainly love to hear from you. Dan in Spring Valley has a question for you. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Say, this I'm a mailman, and I go through quite a few vehicles over the last 30 years. So I bought a right-hand drive Jeep, and after 180,000 miles, I needed a different engine. So I put in a rebuilt, and it's now 10,000 miles later. The engine started out using a quart of oil every 3 days. Now it's a quart of oil a week. Is there any recourse? I know I have a warranty.
Well, the sooner you follow up with the source, whoever you got that engine from, the better off you are. There are different terms that we use for engines in rebuilt. I'm thinking you probably mean remanufactured, but and they do get used interchangeably, but they have very different definitions as far as the Federal Trade Commission is concerned. A used engine is a used engine taken out of another vehicle that was used and has no reconditioning done to it. A rebuilt engine is an engine that someone's taken apart and replaced some components in and rebuilt it, but it's an indeterminate set of components, and the results can be indeterminate too. You could simply take an engine apart and put connecting rod bearings and main bearings in it and call it a rebuilt engine. However, a remanufactured engine is the Federal Trade Commission's definition is that engine has to be completely torn down, rebuilt in kind of a clinical, clean setting, and all of the bearing and shafts and mechanical specifications have to be the same as a new engine. So I think we're probably talking about a remanufactured engine, and they typically have warranties. And you want to read those warranties carefully too, because a lot of is counterintuitive as it seems. A lot of those warranties require a mechanical breakdown, and you can have oil consumption without necessarily having a mechanical breakdown. But if it's using that kind of oil, a valve seal is not in the right place, or a splitter was damaged putting it in, or a piston ring didn't seat properly, or a piston ring is a big C-shaped ring that goes on the piston. There are three of them typically on most engines, and that opening of the C is set up so that they're not all in the same place, so you don't have a gap there. Something like that in the reassembly can cause an engine to use oil that shouldn't. So, I would follow up and with that warranty and try to find out what the cause of this is, sooner than later.
Yeah. Good luck, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Mike in Manitowoc. Your turn, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Yep. Thank you for taking the call. Lately, I have been hearing about being able to use oil filters for 100,000 or 10,000 miles. Normally didn't do that, but I'm just wondering if I can skip an oil filter change when I do my oil at the 5,000 mile typical interval.
I wouldn't recommend that. If there are synthetic oil vehicles that have 10 and even some have 15,000 mile intervals, but that is to change, and that is to change both the oil and the filter at that interval. But I would recommend that the oil filter's got a pretty important job. I mean, because there are wear metals that get into the oil and other contaminants and varnishes. Well, any shop that works on cars typically is going to have to recycle those filters somehow. So we have an oil filter crusher that crushes them, and the gunk that comes out is
amazing.
It's pretty bad. I mean, it's fairly cheap insurance. Oil filters are not extremely expensive. I would recommend changing the filter every time you change oil.
There you go, Mike. Thank you for calling. Kay in Prairie du Chien, it's your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Oops. Something happened.
Nope,
okay,
you're there.
We can hear you.
Oh, because I heard a funny sound. Okay, thank you for taking my call. Okay, now I had switched over. I have a 2003 Dodge Ram, and I switched it over to synthetic at 37,000 miles. It's got 60,000 on it now, and it's running beautiful. But I was also calling in reference. Well, I'm glad I changed it over to that. But I was calling in reference to the guy that had the clunk.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Was that when he put his transmission to go to gold? Because I had similar with my truck.
Well, that was an email, so we didn't really have an opportunity to ask questions about that one. Often, you get these situations where you like to ask a couple questions and clarify. So just like you, I was kind of wondering those things myself.
Yeah.
Okay, what I did was when I put a gear in it, sounded just like it was going to, like the rear end gears, the pumpkin gears.
Uh-huh.
Sounded like they were going to snap off, and it kept doing that. So I took it, and they put it on the computer, and what they had to do is reset the computerized, they got everything's computerized, even
right.
The transmission. So they set that, and that's been over 2 years ago, and say about 2.5, 3 years ago, and it's it's been working perfect since. So that's what that was, is that they had something, there was a glitch in the computer system.
Yep. More and more we see repairs that are simply software reprograms rather than replacement of components. And they probably had some idle speed, you know, setting that they basically just reprogrammed, and a little less harsh of a shift into gear is probably what that was. But yep, that's more and more what we see is a lot of these problems can be resolved by software as opposed to replacing components.
Yeah. Kay, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Well, let's go to Steve in Appleton. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
I have a 30-year-old BMW convertible. It has a lot of vacuum lines, which are original. They've hardened up, but they aren't leaking. And I also have the original brake lines, which are just extruded rubber without any lining or stainless steel braid. I'm wondering if you think it would be prudent as a preventive measure to have those replaced.
Oh, I do. Yep. Yep, absolutely. You know, 30-year-old vehicle that I mean, they may be functioning, but they are definitely on the endangered species list. You know, they're things that are definitely could fail on you at some point. So, yep. No question.
Get her done. Thank you, Steve.
And upgrading is you know, a car that old is you know, you'll probably have fun doing it if you do it yourself, but be glad you do it even if you have somebody else do it. You know, it's probably going to prove to have some challenges, you know, in it. But I would upgrade the components at the same time as well.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck. Rob in Green Lake, your turn. Hi, Rob.
Good morning. I have a 2002 Honda S2000, and the car was bought new in Madison. And I have 161,000 miles on the car, and I'm starting to get misfires. And so I purchased a set of fuel injectors. My question is, with 160,000 miles on the original injectors, should I spend the money to have these rebuilt? And I've got new grommets and seals and such, but it's the internals, the solenoid and the I'm not sure if it's a needle and seat or however the fuel's actually needed. At that kind of mileage, would it be justified to spend the money to have a spare set of injectors? I plan to keep it in the car until my grandkids get it.
If the injectors are the problem, then new injectors rather than that kind of a kit is going to be a better value and a better investment for the durability. And but misfires are often difficult to pinpoint. If we're not absolutely sure that they're injectors, you know, it ultimately what we do often is to change ignition coils and injectors from cylinder to cylinder and track where we move them from to see if the misfire follows a coil or follows an injector, and that's what helps you determine for sure what the problem is, because you know, what you don't want to do is put injectors in it and then still have this misfire and come to find out it was something different. It's very difficult for the onboard diagnostics often to, I mean, sometimes they can give you a code saying specifically it's a coil, but a lot of times it'll be a random misfire or a cylinder misfire without indicating what the source was. So I've just cautioned to, you know, you may want to experiment and swap coils and injectors from different cylinders, mark what they are, so that you've got different ones on, you know, if you know what cylinders they were, swap from another cylinder and mark them so that you know which ones they came from, and that's going to help you determine which is causing it.
All right. Good luck, Rob. Thank you very much for calling. Tim and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Yes, I have a 2008 Tundra with 135,000 miles, and it's been lately having a hard time going from two-wheel drive to four-wheel drive, and then my four highlights flashes, and then it kind of gets locked up in either one. And I don't know if it's the transfer case actuator, or if it's a computer, or if they can diagnose this, or what.
Well, it can be diagnosed, but I will tell you, that is one of the more difficult diagnoses. When they first came out with those systems, they came out with a worksheet for technicians to take. It just looked like a spreadsheet of pen readings, electronic readings, and then call into the engineer so he could tell you what was wrong with it. They've gotten a little better with providing technicians the ability to do that themselves, but you've got an actuator in the transfer case, you've got an actuator in the front differential. They have to communicate to a computer that sees that axles are locked in or are not locked in before it allows it to go in and out of four high or four low for that matter. And ultimately, it's electronic testing essentially. I have seen the connectors are exposed to weather, and they are supposed to be weatherproof, but this is Wisconsin and we know that stuff will creep into anything. So best case scenario is that you've got some oxidized contacts that potentially could be cleaned, but in a more likelihood, we typically see a few more front differential actuator failures, which is a little cheaper to replace than the transfer case actuator. Yeah. But any of those components can cause that, and there is quite an electronic diagnostic process that you need to go through to determine what it is.
Oh, there you go, Tim. Thank you. And Steve in Prairie du Chien, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a 2000 Suburban with 180,000 miles on it, and I was recently rear-ended, at a slow speed. And after that, my tranny started acting up. Is that a coincidence, or could that affect it? It was parked when it happened.
Okay.
Well, I don't know the extent of damage that occurred or what had to be done to repair it. But that could be something. It might have had a transmission fluid leak caused by that might have been repaired when the vehicle repair was done, assuming it was repaired and it wasn't just minor damage, and it could be just fluid level. So the first step is to check the fluid level, because that kind of a symptom, our optimistic best case scenario is that the fluid level is a little low, and correcting that will correct the problem. But from there, there are things that could have been affected that could be misaligned from an accident, and it may be a coincidence. We do see these things. When you start to get a symptom and there's been an incident, you're going to presume it's related, but that's not necessarily the case.
So there you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Great to have with us Jim Ward. He's the service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. Comes by every couple of months to talk with us. He knows a lot, doesn't he? It's always fun. And he'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Jim Ward. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at your vehicle today with Jim Ward. Jim is service manager at Smart Motors Toyota. He has 10 years of master certification. He's been working with vehicles since the late 70s. So he knows a lot, as you probably can tell from listening, if you've been listening. If you have a question about your car, the number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Hansel and Madison, we'll go to you next. Thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
I've got a 2008 Buick Enclave that had a recall on the power steering pump that I was able to get into the dealership, and they replaced it just before the recall expired. Would have ordinarily been a $1,500 to $1,700 expense. So I was excited. Hey, you took care of my problem for me. Mm-hmm. But now, less than a year and a half later, the replacement part has failed. And guess what? The recall is expired, and I'm stuck with replacing the power pump.
Sure.
My question is there any type of regulation that when recalls come up that say that the part that they're replacing needs to be warranted for a certain period of time, or can they just put it in and have it fail a week later and they've done their due diligence?
There are a lot of different types of programs. Once upon a time, what we called a recall had a specific and singular definition. And back at that time, a recall typically was forever. It didn't have an expiration. Now there are, different manufacturers call them different things. They call them campaigns. There are limited campaigns. There are customer support programs. Many manufacturers will have a program that's based on a class action suit that's going to have a limited period of time and mileage. So a safety recall, that's still a consistent a term with a consistent definition. This would not have been a safety recall because a safety recall doesn't expire. Safety recalls can be performed on cars with salvage titles, whereas any other of those programs, limited service campaigns, customer support programs, whatever manufacturers want to call them, don't apply to vehicles with salvage titles. But so the safety recall clearly wasn't the case here with this power steering pump. You know, and in most manufacturers would cover the repair more than once if it happened within the extension. The warranty on those things is often like 2 to 3 years, 25 to 36,000 miles, something in that range, and they may extend them to 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 years, or in 120, 150,000 miles. I have had manufacturers cover components more than once if it happened within that period of time, but once it's outside of that period of time, they're not likely to cover it again. In particular, in the cases with class action suits, there's legal implications that if they do it for one of the claimants, then they have to do it for all of them. So it kind of gets sticky for the manufacturer. They're trying to do a good thing on one hand, but sometimes it can feel kind of like you got the short end of the stick in a situation like yours. So
yeah, especially when it's only been not even a year.
Right. I mean, the one thing though is that most components that are put in, the part also has a warranty. So I would follow up with the manufacturer and just double check that part itself. Usually you get the longer of, so if a part has a 12-month, 12,000 mile warranty, but it was covered by a support program, the support program's now expired, but it's only 6 or 8 months, you may still have a coverage on that part for the parts warranty. So I would look into that, but it's certainly possible that it's a program that simply has expired and there isn't really going to be any more assistance offered.
Oh, there you go, Hansel. Thank you for calling. Nate in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hello.
Hi, Nate. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, guys. I have a question about rodents and wiring. My wife has a 2017 Honda Civic. It's her daily driver. And she came out, this was during the cold snap, out to start her car, and all of her indicator lights were flashing. And after it went in for service, we found that a mouse had nibbled right through a wire harness.
Mm-hmm.
When I questioned the tech about, why would a rodent eat a wire harness, he said that now that newer cars are using corn and soy-based insulation in the wires, that they're more susceptible to rodents nibbling on that. And I'm just curious if there's any merit to that claim. And, if you see a lot of this at your shop, Jim, now.
We do. This is an issue that's seemingly become somewhat epidemic. In 40 years in this business, we used to see that on cars, various kinds of rodents. Sometimes I think, some rodents are a little more cantankerous than others. A groundhog, I think, would chew on something just because, just because it's in his way or there. But the mice, it is true that manufacturers probably, proclaimed a number of years ago that they quit using plastic and using various different types of organic materials, whether it's soy or corn or, it's somewhat proprietary. I don't think manufacturers are volunteering what they're using. And they're certainly not doing it to feed rodents. But as we build homes in what used to be cornfields and, get into those territories, we see more and more of it. And it can be extensive. It might just be a chewed wire that's a fix, but a lot of times a wire harness has to be replaced because of it. It can be a very expensive repair. And typically insurance companies do cover those repairs on the vehicles. And we see mice. I've seen vehicles less than 3 years old totaled out because of extensive mouse damage on, three different harnesses, the ones under the floor for the seat belts, the one in the engine compartment, and the one in the roof, all damaged, and it exceeded the value of the vehicle. Typically, when there are so many different things that are rodent inhibitors, capsaicin is one of the most effective. In fact, Honda even makes a tape to go over wire harnesses that's called mouse tape that is specifically made to prevent that from happening again, because the sad thing is that they'll come right back to the same place. I've had a vehicle that had towed in because a squirrel had chewed up wiring. They got a loaner, which was the same model of vehicle. They went home, and the customer from her dining room window looked out and saw probably the same squirrel jump up on the front wheel. And so she decided, I better put this in my garage, because it apparently had a lot of things in the garage that the vehicle couldn't be pulled in. So in the time it took an hour or so to clear out the garage to be able to pull the vehicle in. The loaner wouldn't start, and yes, indeed, it had the same damage. The thing went to the same place. So we've seen all kinds of animals. This had a new one this winter. Just in this last cold snap, we had a hybrid towed in. Hybrids typically use orange coverings over the high voltage wires as a kind of a warning that, you know, for don't mess with these. There was a rabbit under the hood that had chewed some of this orange wiring, which I just yet wondered, was it the color or is it just coincidence? It's just the strangest thing. I'd never heard of a rabbit before, but this is becoming more of an epidemic thing, and it's rare, particularly in the winter months, that we don't have a vehicle down for some kind of a wiring damage by rodent situation.
So, Nate, your mechanic wasn't trying to give you a bunch of baloney there.
Yeah. Well, no, that's hopefully not.
Yeah,
that's true.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Rick and Madison, your turn.
Thanks, Larry.
Sure.
I have a 2006 Toyota Highlander Hybrid, about 210,000 miles on it. And I'm just wondering, is there an expected lifespan of the hybrid systems? Should those batteries somehow be checked to see if they're still efficient, or can they be replaced? What's the expectation for a hybrid system?
Well, in terms of the checking, it is checked constantly every time you drive it. The hybrid system has got its own onboard diagnostics. That hybrid system is very sensitive. What it really is a battery that consists of a number of separate little battery cells. Each of those cells are actually real similar to what is used like in radio control devices, and ultimately they for the most part, a manufacturer dealer like ourselves would replace the whole battery with a manufacturer battery, with a complete one. There are businesses out there that specialize in rebuilding them. It's not cheap to do, but the systems are very sensitive to each of those separate cells having charge levels that are within a certain tolerance of each other, and they don't have to get very far apart before the hybrid system just isn't going to work right anymore. And again, that's constantly monitored by the onboard diagnostics. If they start to get too far out of whack, you're going to get a warning light come on. It's going to have codes that say specifically that's what's going on, that cell block number blah 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 is out of range, and it's going to have something done, and that may be replacing the whole battery pack, or it might be taking it somewhere and having it rebuilt. The rebuilding and there's kind of a evolving landscape about that, because it used to be a 1-year warranty you got on that replacement battery, which is several thousand dollars to replace, because businesses are springing up that specialize in rebuilding them and saying that they'll guarantee them for, you know, that it may cost 2/3 to rebuild it as it would to replace it with a new one, and they'll guarantee it for 2 or 3 years. Now manufacturers like Toyota have gone to a 3-year guarantee on those replacement batteries, so it's good for the consumers. In terms of how long they last, most of the hybrids out there of any age, even going back to 2001, they still have the original hybrid battery in them. That's not to say they don't fail, though. Just like engines and transmissions, some of them will fail at 75, 80,000 miles. It's like a bell-shaped curve. Most of them are going to go as long as you'd expect an engine or transmission to last, 250, 300,000 miles. So there's a variance that we see, but that at 210, 211,000 miles, I wouldn't expect that its failure is right on the horizon at all.
Yeah. Rick, does that help out?
Yeah, so just no news is good news, and if something happens, it'll tell me.
That's right.
That's the gist of it. Thank you so much for calling. I have a Highlander as well. I really love that vehicle, especially this time of the year in the snow and crappy weather, all-wheel drive and a little bigger vehicle. It's made my winter much nicer than it might have been.
Peace of mind.
Peace of mind. Well, let's go to Tom in DeForest. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a kind of a dovetail question also concerning hybrids. I'm in the process of looking at buying a Toyota Camry hybrid, and presently driving a 2010 Camry that has a floor banger in it. Very happy with that car. The question has to do with the batteries you just answered. And secondly, I was at a local mechanic shop the other day getting an oil change in my truck, and he was throwing cold water on the hybrid idea because he said, for example, let's say your air conditioner goes out, repair there is so expensive that it's almost prohibitive to do. So I guess I'm looking for reassurance. I'm not looking to make a bad decision in general.
You know, we really haven't seen a difference in dependability of hybrid components. You know, you've got a lot more electronic devices on a hybrid than, you know, it's true. Typically, they're going to have an electronic power stream pump. They're going to have electronic air conditioner compressor, and those are likely to be more expensive. But if anything, they seem to last longer than conventional systems that we see. So, you know, I every time a manufacturer comes out with something different, you know, any of us that have been in this business for decades scratch our head and say, man, how's that going to work out? Toyota has you know, and not just Toyota, most manufacturers have really invested a lot into the hybrid technology, and Toyota, you know, among others, really has seemed to have it dialed in. That's not to say that it's not going to be more expensive. These are also those superior operating systems. You know, it's similar to some of the safety systems on new cars. An 18 Camry, for example, whether it's a hybrid or a conventional engine, has got safety systems like the sonar systems and the lane departure cameras. A simple accident repair is likely to cost about $3,500 more on that vehicle because of those sensors and the calibration that have to be done. So with technology and you know, greater durability and convenience and safety of vehicles does come some increased expense, but I don't see lesser durability. I see greater durability in my experience with those systems. So although it might cost more to repair it, if it lasts longer, I think in the end, in the wash, I don't think they're a bad investment.
All right. There you go, Tom. Thank you. And Ruth in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I have a Sprinter, a Dodge Sprinter RV, and it has a Mercedes engine in it, and I was told I don't have to change the oil but every 10,000 miles, which when I first started driving it, I was doing. But now I don't do so many miles, so I haven't been changing it every year. I've been, you know, going a year or so before I change it again. When I do change it, I change the oil filter and the fuel filter, both. Is that a good idea or not?
Typically, you know, because those engines are under a pretty heavy load with an RV, that those are changed at the same interval. And, you know, there is going to be an interval for both mileage and time, and whichever comes first is what you want to pay attention to. So if, you know, that is the type of vehicle that often is used less, so sometimes you have to go by the calendar rather than by the odometer and when to change the oil.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for calling, Ruth. Appreciate it. And let's go to Chris in Cooksville. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Thanks for this program. It's
sure.
Always wonderful to listen for. I have to commend that I owned foreign car specialists for 40 years on Regent Street, and I like listening to those programs because there's so much good information that comes out of the discussions. I appreciate this.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
I have a complaint about modern headlights on vehicles. They're getting brighter and brighter with as the years go on, and I know there's nothing you can do or recommend for me to do, but there are aftermarket lights that people are installing on mostly pickup trucks, it seems, and it's just getting brighter. The use of driving lights and fog lamps in the daytime and early nighttime, it's just getting harder and harder to look for oncoming vehicles. I wonder if you have any input or any views you could offer or suggest or...
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I can certainly relate. I mean, there's a number of different factors here. There are many different styles of headlights. So first of all, just stock headlights that come on the vehicles. I hate to start to cut things up into generational things, but as I get older, that my eyes don't adjust as quickly from bright to dark, coming in out of sunlight and trying to read something inside.
Yeah.
Very difficult, and it's the same way when a vehicle goes by. Often, you know, especially with the aftermarket added-on Xenon type and other types of very bright headlights, I've got to look at that stripe on the right side, and even then, you know, I'm still seeing stars a little bit sometimes afterwards. So I can definitely relate to that. And, you know, it's one of those things that there is a point at which lights are not legal or too bright. I mean, the way vehicles are designed stock, like with fog lights, for example, fog lights should not be able to be on with your brights. They're on with your low beams is the way it's supposed to work. It's not really legal, at least in the state of Wisconsin, to have high beams and fog lights on. But depending on who put the fog lights on and how they wired them, if they're aftermarket, they might be on that way. So, yeah, we all see these vehicles that have lights that are just too bright. But the aftermarket notwithstanding, there are many issues with different styles of headlights too. You know, the high intensity discharge lights, you know, beyond the expense and how bright they are, the projector style lights that are brighter for a specific certain distance, and I see a generational shift of people that over a certain age don't like these projector lights because it seems like they have a cutoff of height. If you're coming up a little bit of a grade to a stop sign, it's like the lights seem to shine just under the stop sign. And, you know, because younger eyes are usually, you know, adjust quicker and easier. Younger people don't usually seem to point that out, you know, but it's not just the age thing. It is just sensitivity of eyesight. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, people can be driving around with illegal lights, but it's other than saying, darn, that's bright, it's not, I don't think, very easily enforced by law enforcement. You know, they may see it, but I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody being pulled over because their lights were too bright. I'm sure it's probably happened, but that's not a common scenario. So that is a danger. I mean, if you have a vehicle out there and you think you're safe because it's so bright you can see anything, keep in mind people are coming head on at you, some of whom are having a hard time even, you know, seeing anything after you pass or even before you pass. So it's a lot of potential unsafe situations out there because of this.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for calling and for listening. Appreciate your call very much. Well, Sherry in Spooner has something for us. Hi, Sherry.
Hi there. I am inquiring about a Subaru Impreza 2012.
Okay.
And it has excessive oil use. And I've had it analyzed several times by mechanics and by Subaru. And they said it's not bad enough for them to repair, but it is a fault with this engine. So I have to add a quart between every oil change.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about that problem with the Impreza?
I do. There are various different manufacturers, you know, Ford, Chevy, Toyota, Subaru, that have some engines that have those issues. Manufacturers have always had standard specifications for oil consumption. I mean, they're all engines use some oil. There's no such thing as an engine that doesn't use any oil, except an engine that's not run. And so it's a matter of degrees. And for most manufacturers, that specification of what was allowable was a quart to 1,200 miles. So if the oil consumption was less than that, then typically you add oil. And because there's such a variance in how people use vehicles, from taxi cabs, which again are not just taxi companies anymore, with Lyft and Uber, any given person may be running their vehicle like that, from delivery services to, you know, all kinds of different things. Manufacturers don't necessarily know how a vehicle is going to be used, and some uses of vehicles will cause more oil consumption. So it's a frustrating thing, but that is a conventional wisdom, is that if your vehicle's not using in excess of whatever that manufacturer's specification is, then you get in the habit of checking oil and adding the oil in between. And as far as the engine's concerned, again, the engines are, I hesitate to say this because I don't want anybody running their engine a quart low, but in most passenger cars, they're engineered to operate just fine at about a quart low. So, that's not a recommendation to run it that way by any means. But, it's a good skill to have, to be able to check your oil and be able to accurately know how to do it and put some oil in anyway. And, you know, unfortunately, I wish I could tell you some secret that was going to allow you to get it fixed under some program. But the reality is that you're probably going to have to keep that up.
Thank you, Sherry. Here's one for you. Can you answer this in 30 seconds? Kevin emailed to ask what the white goo is on the oil dipstick tip, what that means.
That is moisture condensation in most cases. If you take the oil cap off, you can probably see what looks like some mayonnaise or even kind of cream-colored mayonnaise on the inside of that oil cap. You may see it on the dipstick. Particularly this time of year, moisture condensation will occur in the oil to some degree, and that's why we use good oils and oil filters, is to catch as much of that as possible. So, yep.
There we go. And on that note, Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming by today. It's really great to have you with us. And you're back on April 18th.
Sounds great. April 18th.
Good to have him here. He really knows a lot, doesn't he? It's always great to have Jim Ward on. He's the service manager at Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Lots of years experience, and he's really good at explaining sometimes very complicated things and do it in a way that even I can understand. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll talk with J.R. Gettle, the founder of Baker Heirloom Seeds. In the meantime, stay with us.